The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Okay, no microphone, so if anybody needs me to speak up, just yell at me. The development of the Atlantic slave trade and the institution of racial slavery in the United States is one of the darkest chapters in human history. Millions of Africans were kidnapped from their native homes and forced to become laborers in the New World. Slaveholders used incredible violence to justify and enforce enslavement. Slaves were subjected to levels of brutality that are truly difficult to fully grasp. Black families were cruelly torn apart, and individuals could be split up and sold to different slaveholders at any given time. Parents watched helplessly as their children were taken away without warning. Whipping and physical abuse were commonplace, as well as sexual violence and torture. The labor that slaves carried out on a daily basis was painful and exhausting in itself. For example, picking cotton by hand causes tiny cuts in the skin. The eventual abolition of slavery through the Union Army's Civil War victory and the passing of the 13th Amendment was a world historic achievement for democracy and human liberation. Most of us are taught that Abraham Lincoln was the great emancipator who freed the slaves, but rarely do we encounter the history of the decades-long social movement devoted to slavery's demise in the United States. It took a mass movement with popular support to force the issue of slavery onto the national agenda. Anti-slavery sentiment was present in early America and shaped debates during the Revolutionary War, but it took the voices and resistance of black slaves to establish abolition as a political demand, distinct from opposition to slavery's expansion or hoping that the institution would just die out over time. Abolition was an interracial movement with an international scope. Abolitionists in Britain, Africa, and the United States closely followed developments throughout the Atlantic. The formal outlawing of the Atlantic slave trade in 1807 and the success of British abolition in 1833 were celebrated by U.S. abolitionists who would mark the anniversaries of these events as holidays. Both black and white women were influential abolitionists, and women's involvement enforced the movement to include gender in their conception of human rights. In building the struggle against slavery and racism, abolitionists themselves were transformed, and abolition came to encompass a vision not only of the end of slavery, but universal citizenship and an interracial democracy. Slave resistance was the driving force of the movement. The actions of black slaves themselves were not somehow separate from the movement as a whole. Free black and white abolitionists took their lead from the enslaved and centered their aspirations and experiences in their organizing. They published newspapers and pamphlets that carried reports on the abuses endured by slaves, and black authors regularly contributed to and produced this literature. Former slaves, including Frederick Douglass, Harriet Tubman, and Henry Highland Garnett, became some of the movement's most prominent leaders. Activists of all races risked violence and imprisonment by choosing to side with the enslaved. In their time, abolitionists were lampooned by their pro-slavery enemies as out-of-touch utopians and religious fanatics. Unfortunately, I think this still informs how many of us think about and study abolition today. There remains a misconception that abolition was a bourgeois movement led by white liberals. And not only is this inaccurate, but it can lead to the erasure of the immense contributions of black abolitionists and the actions of enslaved black people. Black abolitionists were the prolific journalists, writers, and thinkers of the movement. Their very existence challenged the ideology of racial inferiority used to justify slavery. As socialists, I think it's essential that we have a comprehensive understanding of abolition, and we should claim this history as our own. Abolitionists were the revolutionaries of their day, and we should celebrate their contributions to the black radical tradition that we continue to draw from. I'm going to start by highlighting some examples of slave resistance to really explain why that was so central to the movement. It would be difficult to overstate the importance of slave resistance and rebellions to the politics of abolition. From the earliest days of slavery in North America, enslaved people resisted their bondage and dehumanization. There are countless stories of Africans who were captured and forced to board slave ships, jumping to their deaths in defiance of their captors. Slave mothers were known to induce miscarriages to prevent their children from being born into slavery. Slaves used every tool at their disposal to assert their humanity and resist the oppressive terms of their lives and labor. As W.E.B. Du Bois noted, enslaved blacks regularly implemented work slowdowns and sabotage, like breaking tools, that lessened their master's profits. One woman slave who worked as a cook recounted that she would only do her best cooking for her own family on her day off, while her employers complained about the food that she served to them. The slave system robbed people of their dignity and freedom, but individuals contested this at every opportunity. The Revolutionary War against British rule briefly opened up the possibility of abolition and black rights in the new United States. During the war, free black soldiers fought on both sides. Enslaved people took advantage of the volatility, and some made successful escapes. After the war, slavery was gradually and unevenly abolished in the North on a state-by-state basis. Even in the states where slavery had been outlawed, struggle was always necessary to guarantee black freedom. Individual slaves used the courts to petition for their right to be recognized as free citizens. Not only were slaves allowed to bring charges against their white owners, but many people actually sued for their freedom and won. This is one example where we can see that the history of racial progress is not linear. Racism was not yet so entrenched. So it was not so much of a contradiction that slaves could petition for their rights, and many did. Slaves did not only resist individually, and some of the most inspiring examples are when they collectively organized and rebelled against their slavers. In 1839, illegally purchased Africans aboard the Amistad mutinied and took control over the ship. In 1841, another slave ship uprising on the Creole resulted in 128 slaves successfully winning their freedom. Abolitionist activists organized around both cases to pose legal challenges to pro-slavery interpretations of the Constitution. Violent slave uprisings on land and at sea became a battle cry for abolitionists and the stuff of nightmares for Southern slaveholders. The Haitian Revolution, which began in 1791, ooh. Yeah, we should clap for the Haitian Revolution, served as a shining historical example for all who opposed slavery internationally. African slaves, led by Toussaint Louverture, staged an uprising in Haiti that defeated the combined strength of the most powerful armies of the day. They founded Haiti as the first black republic and a free black nation, demonstrating that people of African descent were not only capable of political self-rule, but willing to risk death to win their freedom. For decades to come, abolitionists continued to celebrate the legacy of the Haitian Revolution and published positive accounts of its history. During his presidency, Thomas Jefferson called the Haitian revolutionaries cannibals of the terrible republic, and set in motion a policy of isolation against them. Abolitionists called for the government's formal recognition of Haiti, but that would only happen much later when Lincoln took office. More than perhaps any other world event, the Haitian Revolution inspired slaves to rebel against their oppressors. Abolitionists frequently cited Haiti as a justification for slave rebellions in the Americas, and proof that Africans were capable and deserving of the rights of citizenship. In 1844, a writer for the abolitionist newspaper, The Liberator, said of Frederick Douglass, "He was like Toussaint among the plantations of Haiti, an insurgent slave taking hold of the right of speech and charging on his tyrants the bondage of his race." The successful slave revolution in Haiti showed the way forward for the abolition movement and allowed people to imagine the possibility of a world without slavery. For all the right reasons, abolitionists saw themselves as part of the same struggle which unfolded in Haiti, and they wanted to bring that same vision of liberation to the United States. Haiti directly helped inspire the largest slave rebellion in U.S. history. This was the 1811 German Coast Uprising, which was led by a man of Haitian descent named Charles Delon. On the night of January 18th of 1811, Delon led an attack on his master's plantation on the German coast of Louisiana, outside of New Orleans. 2 days later, an army of up to 500 slave rebels threatened to overtake white control of the city of New Orleans. DeLon had worked as a slave overseer for a planter named Samuel Andree, and because of this was likely trusted a great deal, because he was charged with overseeing the work of other slaves. Inspired by Haiti, DeLon's goal was to lead local slaves to freedom and establish a free black colony along the banks of the Mississippi. The Andree Mansion where he worked housed the armory for the local planter militia, and DeLon knew that he would need to seize these weapons to have any chance of success. He organized the plantation's workforce, which included a diverse group of slaves. They were born in Africa and America, spoke many different languages, and practiced different religions. It's incredible to imagine the conversations and debates that must have taken place to convince this group of people to join his revolt. DeLon and his men armed themselves with cane knives and tools and entered Andree's mansion at night to seize the guns and ammunition from the armory. They also took military clothing, which they wore to connect themselves to the Haitian revolutionaries, who famously wore European-styled military uniforms. They headed out on foot toward New Orleans, leaving Andree and his son for dead and their plantation in flames. They marched for 2 days along the Mississippi River, burning plantations along the way and bringing more escaped slaves into their band. As word spread of the revolt, planters fled from their homes and planned for a counterattack. The local planter militia, a volunteer army, and federal troops came together to put down the revolt. Tragically, the uprising was brutally crushed. DeLon was tortured and killed on the battlefield, and other leaders were tried and executed. In a display of state terror, their bodies were left out to rot. The severed heads of 100 rebels were placed on pikes stretching from Andree's mansion to New Orleans. Although it ultimately ended in a massacre, the heroic rebellion struck fear into the hearts of many slaveholders and inspired abolitionists to deepen their commitment to their cause. For both sides of the slave conflict, the 1811 uprising in Louisiana signaled that the specter of Haiti had reached the South. Just as the slaves were inspired by Haitians, Southern planters were terrified, and they saw Haiti as a warning for their side to crush any and all rebellions. Slaves also resisted their bondage through escaping as fugitives. African American freedom seekers fled from their master's land and ran to safety in the North and up to Canada. Tens of thousands of fugitive slaves escaped in the years before the Civil War. Historians now estimate that roughly 150,000 enslaved people ran away during the period from 1830 to 1860. A recent estimate that includes temporary runaways and slaves who stayed in the South shows that around 50,000 slaves ran away every year. Fugitive slaves represented the single greatest threat to the slave system, both economically and politically. Every slave that escaped meant a direct loss in profits and property for slaveholders. As a class, the Southern planters were incredibly invested in preventing this loss. This struggle escalated throughout the antebellum period with a series of laws designed to secure the legal interests of slaveholders. The 1850 Fugitive Slave Act significantly raised the stakes for abolition by forcing the free states to uphold slavery and return captured fugitives to their masters. Black freedom seekers sought employment and safety in northern cities. Densely populated urban centers provided greater anonymity against kidnapping and re-enslavement. Slave catchers were a constant threat that terrorized free black communities. I'm sure many of us are familiar with the film 12 Years a Slave, which is based on the life of Solomon Northup, who was born a free man but kidnapped and sold into slavery. In Boston, Philadelphia, New York, and Baltimore, former slaves found refuge and solidarity among interracial abolitionist communities. Independent black political and religious organizations offered social services to support incoming refugees. In turn, fugitive slaves were invited to share their stories of survival as a testament to the evils of slavery and the determination and courage of the slaves. Because of this, many former slaves became activists who wrote and spoke out about their personal encounters with the horrors of the institution. This constant influx of black refugees to urban centers brought the experiences and aspirations of enslaved people into the movement and raised radical demands for immediate abolition and black rights. African Americans who freed themselves played a leading and decisive role in shaping the politics and aims of abolition. During the earlier phase of abolition, many activists had advocated for a gradual end to slavery through reforms. There were efforts to establish apprenticeships so slaves could become free laborers, and laws setting slaves free when they reached the age of 21. Some abolitionists were even proponents of colonization, which was a racist project to send all free blacks back to Africa. Colonization appealed to some abolitionists as well as pro-slavery racists. The overwhelming majority of blacks disagreed with colonization and rightly saw it as rooted in racism. In 1849, Frederick Douglass wrote against colonization in the North Star, and this is what he argued. So far as present indications determine, it is clear that this land must continue to be the home of the colored man. For more than 200 years, we have been identified with its soil, its products, and its institution. Under the sternest and bitterest circumstances of slavery and oppression, under the lash of slavery at the South, under the sting of prejudice and malice at the North, we have lived and continue to live and increase. We deem it a settled point that the destiny of the colored man is bound up with that of the white people of his country, be the destiny of the latter what it may. We are, as laborers, too essential to the interests of our white fellow countrymen to make a very grand effort to drive us from this country among probable events. In making a clear case against colonization, Douglass concludes that because of the development of slavery in America, there is no going back. There can now be no black liberation anywhere in the world until there is freedom for black people in America. He also points to the ways in which slavery has strangely tied the fates of black workers and white workers together. So I'm gonna say a little bit about the importance of media and literature in the movement. Thank you. Anti-slavery media and literature were among abolitionists' most powerful tools. They produced countless publications, newspapers, books, and pamphlets. Slave narratives written by survivors of slavery became incredibly important for bringing the politics of abolition to a wider audience. Abolitionists believed that publishing these narratives would increase awareness of slavery's barbarism, particularly among northern whites. Many authors wove sharp political arguments into their narratives, and so I'm just gonna cite a few examples so we kind of get a sense of what these sounded like. So Henry Bibb, in his narrative, made an economic argument against slavery. He argued, "Who had a better right to eat the fruits of my own hard earnings than myself?" And I think Bibb's story is really fascinating because he actually escaped to slavery to Ohio. So like the first thing he did after escaping was to attend a black political convention that was happening in Detroit. And once he got there, he actually mailed copies of like the meeting minutes to his former master and a bunch of other slaveholders in Kentucky, which I think is incredible. And then I found a quote in another narrative that I think is very powerful that I wanted to share. So this is from William Grimes. His narrative was published in 1825, and he condemns the hypocrisy of freedom built on slavery. "If it were not for the stripes on my back, which were made while a slave, I would, in my will, leave my skin as a legacy to the government, desiring that it might be taken off and made into parchment, and then bind the Constitution of glorious, happy, and free America. Let the skin of an American slave bind the charter of American liberty." And so I think that some of those examples just show how powerful and effective these narratives could be in actually convincing people they should oppose slavery. I'm gonna say a little bit about the Underground Railroad. So the railroad was not just a network of escape routes that slaves could travel, it was part of the infrastructure of the abolition movement. The Underground Railroad has roots in what were called vigilance committees, which were founded by black abolitionists to create funds to aid colored persons in distress. Those who lent their homes and efforts toward aiding fugitive slaves did so at great personal risk. The white abolitionist Jonathan Walker became a hero of the movement when he was convicted for helping slaves to escape, and as punishment, his hand was branded with SS for slave stealer. So the symbol of his branded hand, meant to terrify people, like becomes a symbol of liberation for people in the movement. Providing assistance to fugitive slaves was a crucial form of activism, and abolitionists recognized it as such. I think it's impossible to talk about the Underground Railroad without mentioning Harriet Tubman. Tubman is synonymous with the Underground Railroad, but I think she deserves to be remembered as an abolitionist and a political leader in her own right. The activists of the Underground Railroad who took the biggest risks were those who dared to travel into slave territories and lead slave refugees back north with them. They called themselves abductors because the people who opened their homes along the trail to the north were called conductors. Tubman was undoubtedly one of the most successful abductors and one of the only known fugitive slaves willing to risk return to the South. At first, returning to the South meant risking re-enslavement, but by the end of her Underground Railroad career, Tubman had a bounty on her head for slave stealing. In her final trip south, Tubman willingly risked capture and execution, but she was never caught, and none of the slaves she assisted were ever captured. In 1820 or 1822, Harriet Tubman was born Araminta Ross in Maryland. Her mother's name was Harriet, and she later adopted the name when she had freed herself. Tubman first returned to Maryland to rescue her own family members, but later she would return with larger groups of fugitives she bore no relation to. Incredibly, Tubman made all her trips into the South when she was in her 20s. Though she sometimes disguised herself as an old woman, she was only 35 when Lincoln was elected in 1860. Tubman also experienced chronic epileptic spells after she had suffered a near-fatal head injury as a child. She sometimes horrified the people that she was helping to escape, because along their journey she would lose time and completely forget things that had happened. Tubman was not the kindly mammy figure of abolition. She was a revolutionary activist. In total, she made 19 trips south and guided over 300 slaves to freedom. During the Civil War, she helped free at least 750 more people during the Combahee River Raid alone. I'm going to end by talking a little bit about women and the abolition movement overall. So both black and white women were heavily involved in abolition at every level. Women wrote and delivered speeches against slavery, formed organizations and female anti-slavery societies, and became leading activists. Through their involvement in the fight for racial equality, women of all races were forced to take up the question of gender and defend their place in the public sphere. The Quaker abolitionist Angelina Grimke argued that white women must stand against slavery as women and as mothers. And here's a passage from one of her articles. "We do not then and cannot concede the position that because this is a political subject, women ought to fold their hands in idleness and close their eyes and ears to the horrible things that are practiced in our land. The denial of our duty to act is a bold denial of our right to act. And if we have no right to act, then may we well be termed the white slaves of the North, for like our brethren in bonds, we must seal our lips in silence and despair." Women who defended the humanity of slaves gained the confidence to claim their own humanity as well. Abolition ultimately gave rise to the first feminist movement in the United States. An overwhelming number of women's rights activists cut their teeth opposing slavery. In 1848, the same year that Marx and Engels published the Communist Manifesto, 200 abolitionist men and women met in Seneca Falls, New York, for the first ever women's rights convention in the United States. The conference was convened by Lucretia Mott and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who had met each other at the 1840 World Anti-Slavery Convention in London, where women were barred from speaking from the floor. It was this experience of marginalization that led them and many others to organize for women's rights in tandem with abolition. The abolitionist men who worked alongside women had to take a stance on the woman question. William Lloyd Garrison and Frederick Douglass both defended the role of women in the movement. Garrison argued, "I wrong the slave in dishonoring or casting one obstacle in the way of his female advocate." And Douglass actually includes women in the motto of his North Star newspaper. And the motto was, "Right is of no sex, truth is of no color, God is the father of us all." So I think that overall, abolition shows us how a small and possible movement can actually grow to become a mass movement powerful enough to overturn a centuries-long system of oppression. In an era of incredible oppression against blacks and women, abolition brought together men and women, black and white, and abolition has never wavered in their belief that a better world was necessary. And I hope this history today can empower us to do the same.
Thanks. I should have mentioned both Lauren and Michael are ISO members and activists here in Chicago. So also checkout was at 12, so if you need to do something about that, you may want to consider that. But come back.
Yeah, I might need to do something about it too. That's good to hear. So I'm going to build on a lot of the things that Lauren laid out there, and hopefully get to some deeper questions about the abolitionist movement in the United States and internationally. So as Lauren said, throughout the existence of slavery, there was always fierce resistance, led first and foremost by those who were enslaved. That resistance, from uprisings on slave ships in the Middle Passage, to Maroon escapees, to slave rebellions and conspiracies, set the tone and leadership of the abolitionist movement. And additionally, it was the activism of free Black Americans in fighting to secure their rights as full citizens, forming their own social institutions and abolitionist societies, that determined the priorities of the broader abolitionist movement as a whole, much more so than the personalities of abolitionists more well known to history. The movement to abolish slavery and to secure equal rights was far more interracial, international, and working class, and much more responsive to the changing world events than the narrative of abolitionism as a movement of eccentric, middle-class white preachers. Abolitionism had much more of a character of a mass movement, full of its own debates and trends, but full of a radicalism that questioned the American Republic to its core, and anticipating the great struggles that would occur after the Civil War in Reconstruction and so on. The form that resistance to slavery took was deeply tied to the social and economic basis of the society at that time. And as slavery in America changed, so too did that resistance. Manisha Sinha, which both me and Lauren work on our book, The Slave's Cause, identifies two waves of abolitionism, and they roughly correspond to a change in the locus of slavery from the predominant cultivation of tobacco to the cultivation of cotton further south and west. This change is monumental, as cotton cultivation requires many more slaves, involved in high intensity labor year-round, and it becomes much more lucrative for slave owners. This enormous shift has gigantic ideological and strategic repercussions for both abolitionists and slave owners. It's not a coincidence that slave owners in the early 19th century, think Thomas Jefferson and others, would have a kind of apologetic posture towards slavery, and they would make gestures towards the hope of a gradual abolition before later in the century insisting that slavery itself was a positive good for their peculiar institution. In the first wave of abolitionism, terminating in the early 19th century, many abolitionists appealed to this moral sense of slave owners in the hopes that there would be a gradual ending through voluntary manumission. Even some of these early abolitionists were themselves former slave owners. And it was not just a historical naivete, as though it looks to ourselves. There were thousands of manumission societies throughout the early colonial period, and the majority of them were in the South. Many of the slaveholders kind of entertained the idea that slavery would die out on its own. But with the shift to cotton cultivation and the spur this has on the world market for the Industrial Revolution and the transition to capitalism, that it becomes clear that the ending of slavery requires a revolutionary change in society. We know now, obviously, that slavery never would have died out on its own. Indeed, even in the North, where slavery was not deeply rooted economically, it took the fierce, constant activism of Black Americans and abolitionist allies to end it. And even with that activism, slavery took decades to die in the North. Once freed, Black Americans in the North faced extraordinary racism and discrimination, even from putative allies against the system of slavery, and organizations like the American Colonization Society, which had thousands of members, some of them also former founding fathers, which said ostensibly was against the institution of slavery, but wished to remove the free Black population and settle them in Africa. This, of course, was opposed nearly unanimously by the free Black population, and it's opposition to colonization that kickstarts Black abolitionism as an organized force in America. So free Black Americans had to struggle at every level of society. Indeed, some of the first recorded civil rights struggles are of Black Americans fighting to find places where they can bury their dead as they are barred from segregated funeral-like graveyards. So what is reported, you know, is Black Americans pooling together their resources to buy land for their own graveyards. Again and again, you find a pattern of Black Americans expelled from majority white spaces and forced to organize themselves as a community for the necessity of life. And perhaps the first organized walkout in American history occurs in 1792, when Absalom Jones and Richard Allen lead a walkout out of the St. George Methodist Church in Philadelphia. They had dared to pray in the front pews reserved for whites, rather than the segregated galley designated for Black people. Absalom Jones went on to found the African Episcopal Church, and Richard Allen, the Methodist Mother Bethel Church. There was a flourishing of Black churches formed all over the United States, which formed a crucial financial and organizational backbone to the abolitionist movement, not just for Black abolitionists, but for white abolitionists that were alienated from the white church. Not restricted to just places of resource of worship, in 1807, the African Benevolent Society was established, which helped take on community functions, ensure proper funerals, registering births, deaths, and marriages, and most importantly, to establish and run Black schools to ensure Black Americans had access to education. In the early 1800s, Black activism explodes against colonization. In 1817, in Philadelphia, Black abolitionist James Forden organized a meeting in protest of the founding of the American Colonization Society, and more than 3,000 Black Americans attended. They even held a vote of those in attendance, and they recorded a unanimous nay vote of the 3,000 people there, Black men and women, part of that the vote. Peter Williams, pastor of the St. Philip's Episcopal Church, says at this meeting, "We are natives of this country. We ask only that we be treated as well as foreigners. Not a few of our fathers suffered and bled to purchase its independence. We ask only to be treated as well as those who fought against it." The colonizationists, it's a mouthful, fired back on this. One Southern writer writes to attack the Jacobinical doctrine of the rights of man. And another said that abolitionists adhered to a principle of agrarianism, since it leveled all distinctions of society, rank, color, caste, and sex, which sounds pretty good to me, but, you know. The activism of Black abolitionists made it untenable for white anti-slavery activists to support colonization. In 1827, the first unapologetically Black newspaper, Freedom's Journal, was founded by Samuel Cornish and John Russwurm. In their opening editorial, they wrote, "Daily slandered, we think there ought to be some channel of communication between us and the public, through which a single voice may be heard, in defense of 500,000 free people of color. We wish to plead our own cause. Too long have others spoken for us." Freedom's Journal only ran about 2 years, but helped build on the networks of Black organizations and churches. To quote the editors, the newspaper was a medium of intercourse between our brethren in different states. It was also distributed internationally, appearing in Canada, Britain, and Haiti. And around this time in Boston, the first explicitly Black organization of abolitionists was formed, the General Colored Association. Its charter noted that it was established for racial betterment and slave abolition. It was committed to racial uplift, organized against colonization, organized against Massachusetts discriminatory laws, and helped in establishing schools and churches in the Black community. Black abolitionists fought against colonization, but drew a sharp distinction between that forced degrading repatriation of African Americans to Liberia with voluntary emigration, often to Canada and, importantly, Haiti. Freedom's Journal sang Haiti's praises, celebrating the firm establishment of a free government by those who were lately in the bonds of slavery. Black abolitionists did not celebrate July 4th, but instead recognized January 1st. The day Haiti proclaimed independence and the day of the abolition of the Atlantic slave trade in the United States. Haiti's constantly invoked by abolitionists, white and Black, as both a positive example of a Black republic and as a warning to slave owners. In responding to a Southern writer's attack, Freedom's Journal wrote, "The day will come when all we have read about Spartacus and his servile band, of the horrors of the revolutionary scenes in Saint Domingo, Haiti, will be reenacted before our eyes." In 1829, a member of the GCA and a writer and agent for Freedom's Journal releases, and this is a mouthful, Walker's Appeal in 4 articles, together a preamble to the colored citizens of the world, but in particular and very expressly to those of the United States of America, also known as Walker's Appeal, and it takes the entire nation by storm. It's directed primarily the audience of Black Americans. Do not 208 years of intolerable sufferings teach us the actual necessity of a general union among us? But it is an unflinching broadside on racism in America. Walker calls out Thomas Jefferson in particular. Jefferson was a constant target by abolitionists for his endorsement of scientific racism. And Walker encourages free black Americans to, quote, go to work and enlighten, and for the international goal of, quote, the entire emancipation of your enslaved brethren all over the world. Walker's appeal was distributed all over the United States and was found among free and enslaved black people in the South. In 1831, Nat Turner's rebellion occurred. Turner, a slave who was a talented and inspiring preacher with about 60 other slaves, attempted to storm the arsenal in Jerusalem, Virginia, and freed slaves, burned down plantations along the way. Turner's rebellion was brutally suppressed, and in the ensuing white backlash, hundreds of free and enslaved black people were brutalized and killed, far more than the number of whites killed by Turner's uprising. Government authorities explicitly linked the spread of abolitionist propaganda to Turner's rebellion. The governor of Virginia said Yankee peddlers and the incendiary publications of Walker, Garrison, and Knapp led to the uprising. Well, in the wake of Turner's rebellion, the Virginia legislature passed more sweeping, punishing restrictions on free black people. It also, almost without precedent, openly debated emancipation on the floor of the legislature. The western part of Virginia favored a gradual emancipation, but slave owners were able to reassert control and deny any resolutions from passing. That same year, a few months later, a slave rebellion in Jamaica of nearly 60,000 hastened the abolition of slavery in Britain, British colonial holdings. The uprising started initially as a work slowdown and a strike, and progressed into burning sugar factories and plantation. The uprising was put down with notable brutality, but by 1833, emancipation was passed in Britain. It is in this context of free black self-organization and massive slave revolt that William Lloyd Garrison's The Liberator and the American Anti-Slavery Society come into being in the early 1830s. Garrison's first issue of The Liberator was published on January 1st, that date is always significant, in 1831, and from the beginning, it was a militant interracial project. James Forden, the black abolitionist that organized the Anti-Colonization Forum in Philadelphia, subsidized the paper in its first years, and 450 of the first 500 subscribers were black. The Liberator employed black writers and black agents all over the country, including in Haiti. Garrison, known to history as a pacifist, however, was a firm defender of black people's right to self-defense. He defended the Haitian Revolution and called Nat Turner's rebellion a dastardly triumph, well becoming a nation of oppressors. In 1832, also on January 1st, William Lloyd Garrison and his collaborators established the New England Anti-Slavery Society. The NEASS distinguished itself from previous anti-slavery societies in insisting on immediate emancipation for all African Americans without compensation. Within the year, 50 other organizations modeled on the NEASS were formed. And by the end of the year, delegates met to form the national group, the American Anti-Slavery Society, of which about one-tenth of the delegates were black. The American Anti-Slavery Society had something of the character of a mass movement. By 1838, there were well over 1,000 branches and auxiliaries, and between 100,000 and 250,000 members, which was close to around 1% of the population of the North. There were youth auxiliaries, women auxiliaries, and the General Colored Association voted to affiliate and merge with the AASS, and the national organization made connections with Canadian, French, British, and Haitian abolitionist societies. This was part of an international abolitionist movement. Garrison went on to a speaking tour in Britain to organize against colonization schemes, and was there in 1833 to witness the passage of the Emancipation Bill. The membership of the AASS was overwhelmingly made of poor farmers and working class urban dwellers. Black abolitionists were relatively worse off, typically barred in the North for more well-paying job and denied access to land. Abolitionist newspapers made a point to help uplift what black businesses there were, carrying advertisements for black-owned groceries and clothing shops. They made a point to specify what hotels and inns were allowed black patrons, and they maintained free publicity for black organizations to list their meeting times and locations to the public. Members of the American Anti-Slavery Society risked much. Many faced economic reprisal, losing jobs and opportunities, and faced social ostracism and violence. Garrison received death threats constantly and was mobbed several times, once nearly killed in a violent riot. Venues that hosted interracial meetings would be burned. Printing presses would be smashed. In 1837, Elijah Parrish Lovejoy, an abolitionist preacher in Alton, Illinois, as you know, a free state, fired back at a mob that set out to destroy his printing press. He was killed in the gunfire and became a martyr for the movement. In 1839, the movement splits. And the split is, like every kind of split in a left-wing movement, kind of complicated and arcane and hard to find, kind of figure out. But generally, it's over Garrison's uncompromising criticism of the clergy, his refusal to engage in electoral politics, and his support for women's rights. Many of those that split from Garrison go on to form the Liberty Party, an abolitionist third party. And on that point, I don't think it's a coincidence that those that go into the electoral route are capitulate on some questions that may have hurt them in the ballot box. A few words on the Liberty Party. The two dominant parties at the time, the Whigs and the Democratic Party, both contained small handfuls of anti-slavery politicians, but there didn't exist a coherent political pole against slavery. The formation of the Liberty Party set out to break off those who voted for anti-slavery Whigs, and what they said there, which I find there's some big irony here, Liberty Party members told anti-slavery voters, don't throw away your vote on the Whig Party. Which is kind of ironic for the day. The party also adopted a sort of working class platform. It endorsed the movement for the 10-hour day, progressive taxation, land reform, the abolition of war, which is, I think, a big-time platform right there. The Liberty Party did not have much success electorally, but it set the stage for the Free Soil Party in 1848, and a much bigger break that would lead to the formation of the Republican Party in the 1850s. Political and economic developments bring many more Northerners into opposition to the expansion of slavery and sectional conflict with the South. With capitalism ascendant in the North, slavery becomes increasingly entrenched in the South. And given that slavery can only grow in two ways, by adding more slaves and by adding more land, the South fought for a fiercely expansionist and imperialist policy to the West and abroad. In the early 1840s, abolitionists fought the annexation of new states, and they fought the annexation particularly of Texas into the Union, sending 180,000 petitions to the Congress in protest. In 1848, those that were involved in the Liberty Party helped form the Free Soil Party, which ran on two major slogans: no more slave states and no more slave territory, and free soil, free labor, free speech, and free men. The Free Soil Party was a single-issue party, opposed to the spread of slavery, though not necessarily for the immediate abolition of slavery and not necessarily to black civil rights. Cadre from the Liberty Party formed the left wing, continuously pushing for black equality and immediate abolition. Free Soilism managed to knit together the interests of classes that may have an antagonistic relationship with them between each other, but were united in opposition to slavery as a system. For free farmers, it promised no more competition with slave owners over land. For laborers, it promised the dignity of work and the possible promise of cheap land in the West after Native Americans were dispossessed of their land. And for the growing power of industrial capitalists, it promised not just the ending of a territorial competition, but also the breaking up of the political power of slavery that frustrated attempts at instituting a protective tariff and investment in infrastructure for railroad and canal construction. All had a stake in politically containing and eventually destroying slavery, but not all had the same stake in black equal and civil rights. The Free Soil Party immediately doubled the vote of the Liberty Party and gained 10% of the electorate in the presidential election of 1848, and managed to break off Whig parties, Whig members, and elect an impressive number of congressmen and senators. Garrisonians attacked the compromises that the Liberty Party abolitionists had to make, while pushing for disunion, charging the Constitution as pro-slavery and supporting the implicit right of revolution. As sectional conflict grew and compromise after compromise with slavery was torn up, 1850 became a turning point for anti-slavery activism. A federal government apparatus fully in the thrall of pro-slavery politicians and a deeply conservative Supreme Court, which sounds very familiar, led to the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850, basically abridging freedom laws in all of the North, making all free blacks vulnerable to being kidnapped and sent to the South, and criminalizing the assistance of fugitive slaves. In response, abolitionists and free blacks, black people mobilized. In New York, 2,000 people met at a fugitive slave convention and armed themselves. proclaiming that they would not hesitate to shoot an American slaveholder, and if the American revolutionists had an excuse for shedding one drop of blood, then have the American slaves' excuse for making blood flow even to the horses' bridles. The Western Anti-Slavery Society adopted a new slogan. It's three words: death to kidnappers. This is from a supposedly pacifist organization. The militancy wasn't reduced to just mere phrase-mongering, but action. In many northern cities, vigilance committees were set up, made up largely of working-class black citizens, prepared to put their bodies on the line to defend fugitives. Here's one such example from James McPherson's Battle Cry of Freedom. In February 1851, a black waiter who had taken the name Shadrach when he escaped from Virginia a year earlier was seized in a Boston coffee house by agents to whom he was serving coffee. They rushed him to the federal courthouse while an angry crowd gathered outside. Denied the use of state facilities by the personal liberty law, a handful of deputy federal marshals tried to guard Shadrach. Suddenly, a group of black men broke into the courtroom, overwhelmed the marshals, and snatched Shadrach away to put him on the Underground Railroad to Canada. While Shadrach settled in Montreal, where he opened a restaurant, an uproar ensued behind him in the States. Abolitionists exulted. Thus, Shadrach is delivered out of his burning, fiery furnace, wrote Theodore Parker. I think this is the most noble deed done in Boston since the destruction of tea in 1773. It was activism like this, little known and unheralded, which occurred dozens of times, that forced a crisis that climaxed with the Civil War and the ending of slavery. Ultimately, it took the combined efforts of black Americans fighting for their freedom, refusing to be treated as second-class citizens, and uncompromising radicals and idealists, experiments in new political forms and coalitions, and above all, direct and revolutionary action to overthrow slavery. Thank you.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.